the briefing from the ages of the consultation of matters, so we can just include that in into our agenda, starting with apology, adoption of agenda, then the briefing by the ages office, then the deliberations on the labor bills, and then the way forward and closure in that manner. Can we have a mover and a seconder?
Thanks, Chair. I move for the adoption of the amendment.
Honourable Teku is moving. Honourable Bagram is seconding. Thank you. So we move forward. I assume that we still have our standing apologies. We didn't receive other apologies. Please take note, honourable members, that I've advised the department to join us a little bit later, because they actually not needed at this briefing. So when you are not seeing them, don't think that they won't pitch today. They will join us immediately after we're done with the AG office. So on that note, we immediately give over to the AG's office for the briefing. Thank you, the floor is yours. Can you just introduce your team as well? Your mic, please.
Thank you, Chairperson. Firstly, let me introduce myself once more. Mudiyedis Kosana, I'm the senior manager responsible for audit of compensation funds, and I'm with Simboni Lemanzi. He is the product champion, and Indirani Maharaj is the manager responsible for Department of Labor. And apology for our business executive who couldn't make it today. And Sim Boni Lemanzi will take us through the introductory part of the presentation, which mostly deals with the legislative requirements of the reviews that we have performed during the process until the period of 31st of December 2017.
Thank you, Mazi. Good morning, Chairperson. Good morning to the honorable members. Thank you again for the opportunity to come and engage with you this morning. Regarding my presentation, let me just apologize firstly that we couldn't circulate the slides before today's session. And also you will note that there is some numbering on my slide that is not quite showing. So apologies for the inconvenience that may cause. Chairperson, if I go to the first slide, there's a slide there that has got the heading, Our Reputational Promise or Mission. So this slide basically just talks about who we are as the AG, why do we exist, and it states as such that we have a constitutional mandate, and we are the Supreme Court Institution of South Africa. We exist to strengthen our country's democracy by enabling oversight, accountability and governance in the public sector through our auditing, thereby building public confidence. So today's engagement is part of that strengthening of the oversight, because we seek with these engagements to empower you to be able to engage with the auditees within the portfolio in terms of achieving better audit outcomes. Then, Chairperson, if I can take you to slide 4. Slide 4 basically talks about the purpose of this briefing, which is to provide the Chairperson and the portfolio committee members with audit insights on the audit areas of the department and its entities in order to add value to the oversight functions, as well as the audit of the 2018 and 2019 annual performance plans. Chairperson, this presentation will touch on two things. One thing is the interim review of APPs, annual performance plans, for the 2018-19 audit cycle. Then the second part of the presentation will be reflecting on the status of records review. So these two items, Chairperson, they are not mandatory actions or reviews that we undertake at the office, but rather they are a reflection of the initiatives that we are putting in place as an office to try and partner with the committee as well as the auditees, so that ultimately we can achieve better audit outcomes for the portfolio and ultimately enhance the service delivery that is delivered to the ordinary citizens of the country. The interim reviews of annual performance plans, Jefferson, is something that we've been doing for quite a number of years. We do believe that the results of this initiative are starting to show. The status of review of records review is a new initiative that we have recently introduced, which basically looks we go in during the year to basically assess the progress of the entities in terms of addressing issues that were raised in the previous financial years. Audit. So, Sir President, with respect to the review of annual performance plans, we have reviewed the draft annual performance plans for the 2018-19 audit cycle. If I can take you, Sir Chairperson, to slide number 7, which talks about the BEF grant and the applicable legislation. So the exercise that we do on the interim review of the annual performance plans, it links with or is informed by the following documents: the National Developmental Plan, the Medium-Term Strategic Framework, the Framework for Managing Program Performance Information, which is issued by the National Treasury, the Framework for Strategic Plans and Annual Performance Plans, issued by the National Treasury, as well as the instruction note number 33, which is a framework for strategic plans and annual performance plans. So these documents, Chairperson, inform the performance plan of the entities within the portfolio, as well as of the department. So when we looked then at the, I'm now on slide 8, Chairperson. When we looked at the draft 2018-19 annual performance plans, we assessed the process followed by the department to prepare and submit strategic plans and annual performance plans. We assessed the measurability and relevance of the final draft indicators and targets for the plans selected programs. Now, the findings, Chairperson, that come from this interim review of annual performance plans, they do not get reported in audit reports for the year under review, but rather they are reported in the management report, so that management can take note of the findings and address the findings before the final annual performance plans are actually submitted to yourselves and approved. On the next slide, Chairperson, we get into a little bit more detail in terms of the criteria used to assess the draft annual performance plans. So we look at two main things when we do this in the review of the draft annual performance plans. We look at the measurability of indicators and targets, whereby we look at whether the indicators are well defined, which means that they are clear, they are unambiguous. We look at whether the indicators are verifiable, which means that the entities have got systems in place that will actually enable them to properly report on the achieved performance. We look at whether the targets are specific, they are measurable, and they are time-bound. Now, when we talk about targets being a specific, Chairperson, we mean that the nature and level of the planned performance is actually can clearly identified. And then, Chairperson, will also look at whether the indicators and targets included in the performance planning documents are relevant, which means that they relate logically to the mandate of the institution, whether it's the department or the entities that are reporting to the department. The next slide, Chairperson, with the heading Smart Criteria for the Performance Targets, is really what I've just said, which talks to the whether the indicators and targets are specific, are measurable, are achievable, are relevant, and are time bound. Then the next slide, Chairperson, with the heading Review Findings on the Draft 2018-19 Annual Performance Plan, indicates that basically there were no material issues that were identified from the review of the draft and the performance plan. So again, Chairperson, like I've said, I think this is a reflection of the results of the efforts that is being put in with this review of the draft APPs. Okay. And then, Chairperson, if I can take you two slides ahead, then the next slide I'm going to talk to say this, but the heading, Key Committee Considerations when Reviewing the 2018-19 Annual Performance Test. So basically, this slide just indicates things that we think the committee can consider when it reviews annual performance tests. And these are whether the annual performance plan aligns with the MTSF and the National Development Plan, whether there is a logical link between the objectives, indicators, and targets, whether the indicators are relevant and complete, whether the indicators are in target as much, whether the institutions have got adequate human and financial resources to be able to achieve their targets. I think this assessment will also be helped by the reasons that auditors normally provide for achievement or non-achievement of said targets. The committee can also look at how can the annual performance plans be achieved, for instance, in terms of having performance agreements with the staff so that they get held accountable for delivering on the targets within their areas of responsibility. And then also the committee can review the quarterly progress against the targets. You can also review the annual achievement of the targets as reported by the institutions. And also you can review and track changes to the strategic plans and annual performance plan, as well as obtaining and understanding exactly of the reasons why such changes are being made to the strategic plans and annual performance plans. Chairperson, at this point I'm going to hand over to my colleague Modiehi, who is going to talk you through the next part of the presentation.
Thank you, Sim. Thank you, Chairperson. Just before I start with my presentation on slide 14, I just want to take the committee back to slide 11, where Sim Bogide presented the findings on measurability relevance. We reported that there were no material findings on measurability and relevance, but with regard to measurability, there's a note below on the bottom of the slide where we're saying that the measurability criteria conclusion may change when we audit the reported information because it depends on the information that management submit to us. If we are not able to measure that particular information that was reported, then this conclusion may change because this particular conclusion is based on the blank information. Moving on to slide 14, status of records review. The status of records review was performed at the department UIF and CF for the period ending 31st of December 2017. And the outcomes were discussed with DG, the accounting officer, on the 12th of February 2018. And moving on to slide 15, the objective of this high-level review, which is the status of records review, is to go in after the audit and the reporting of the audit outcome immediately after the audit, we go in to identify the areas of concern that may perhaps delay management from preparing the financial statements and performance reports and that have integrity and compliance with laws and regulations and causing the entities of the department to regret. And another objective of this initiative is to follow up on the implementation of action plans and also to assess the status of key focus areas, whether there have been improvement or not, and also identify the methods that add value in putting measures and action plans in place in advance to mitigate the risks in the department and the entity. And then after completing the review process, we then update the key focus areas. From the time when we audited, we would have assessed the status of internal control. So when we go in, we then update with the assessment review outcomes. And at Dole, all of the key focus areas remain the same as consent identified. And I will explain in the following slide why was that status the same. Compensation funds, similarly, the status had not changed as of the 1st of December 2017 when we went in. And at UIF as well, when we went in and looked at the action plans and the activities of management to address the internal control deficiency. Slide 18. And as well, the data of key focus areas remains unchanged. And on slide 19, to explain those three slides that where the data had not changed. For CF, the financial health, we're saying it remains a challenge for us to assess the financial health due to the disclaimer of opinion in the critical areas of the financial statements that we would use to calculate the ratios for this financial health assessment. And then oversight and monitoring focus area. For all DOL, CF, and UIF, the action plans have not been fully effective to enable timely correction of prior misstatements and to address internal control deficiencies that were reported. And on the area of financial management at DOL, there were still weaknesses on the areas of financial statements such as financial lease commitments, employee benefits, particularly lease entitlements, and intangible assets. And then at UIF and CF, the entities were in the progress of consolidating the investments that we had reported in the past that resulted in UIF being disclaimed, so management was busy consolidating those unlisted investments. And at CF, there were related parties that we highlighted to management and DG that they should be careful of to make sure that transactions that are entered into with those related parties are at arm's length. And in view of the fact that in the past we reported inadequate contract management. So if you have inadequate contract management and you have contracts with related parties, that your risk of entering into transactions that are not at arm's length becomes higher. So we just highlighted that to management. And then moving on to slide 22, a focus area of performance management. Again, at DOL and CF, management was busy implementing action plans on performance information. And procurement and contract management, We highlighted as dolls that even though as dolls there were no findings on procurement and contract management, however, with the functions of procurement and doll being decentralized to the regions, that increases the risk of perhaps controls not being effective throughout the year if not monitored closely. So we highlighted that to management to pay close attention so that there are no findings. And then at CF, with procurement and contract management, the way we had previously reported inadequate contract management at CF, and when we went in during this review process, we saw that there was IT contract that was extended, and with possible fruitless and wasteful expenditure on other contracts, and we said that is because of that inadequate contract management that we previously reported, and so we said to management, please strengthen your controls in this area so that when we come, we don't report it, or you don't incur fruitless and wasteful expenditure because that is not necessary. And then moving on to slide 24. Compliance management. This area has been reported over the years, SCF, the fraud investigation and the consequence management, the financial misconduct. There are still high number of fraud cases on the register of fraud cases at CF, sitting at 116. 14 of those cases have still not been investigated, and 12 of those cases were older than 1 year with the estimated value of 6.6 million. And with financial misconduct cases, it was sitting at 216 cases. Again, the progress was slow, and there were 168 cases that are still under investigation. And the cases were investigated for a period of about a year to 4 years. And our concern really there was that the staff or responsible officials resign before the investigations are concluded and information gets lost in the process. With regard to human resource at CF, we say given the outcome of the disclaimer environment, the positions at executive level are filled, however, the impact has not yet been realized. And according to the action plan that management submitted to us for review, management itself identified lack of implementation there, or lack or the reason for the internal control deficiencies as lack of skills. So that has to be addressed. And IT management focus area for DOL, CF and UIF, the action plans were still in progress to address the previously reported internal control deficiencies. And the following slide, SCF, slide 24, slide 25, heading is key matters of attention, compliance management, focus area, the additional matters at CF. We have included this slide particularly for CF because of the challenges that CF is facing to highlight the fraud risk indicators in that environment. One of them being the high number of fraud and financial misconduct investigations, the fraud indicator, duplicate payments that we made in the past and low loan issues and not being recovered, so statement not in support of lots of transactions and balance, account balances, and the internal control efficiencies in the areas of sales and revenue, and the recent expected fraud incidents. Those we say are really areas that are opening up the entity to fraud. And we also in slide 27 for CF particularly our concerns there is that culture of poor performance and weak internal control environment and lack of agency and commitment to improve the control environment, which may lead to increased instances of fraud and could also lead to possible depletion of funds in future. And we have also reported that if that environment remains the way it is, we will have fraud taking place. And our other concern is that you will have new appointments and some existing employees, dedicated, hardworking people who may be overworked because other people are not performing. It's either they will resign and CF will lose those hardworking people, or they will join in and do what other people are doing of not performing and not being committed and poor work ethics and so forth. And we also highlighting our other concern is just inadequate mechanisms in place to monitor consultants who are brought in to assist in improving or addressing challenges faced by the entity. And this, if you're not monitoring your consultants, obviously they will not deliver on the terms that they agreed upon in the contract, leading to contract extensions that I alluded to earlier on and financial loss to the entity. And I have also put the overall recommendations for CS that management must, there must be good and strong work ethic. Management must demonstrate it from top down to the lower staff members. And management should also communicate clear expectations, because for management to hold staff accountable, they must communicate expectations to them and hold them accountable for poor performance at all levels. We also say management must stabilize the IT system to ensure optimal use instead of changing IT systems without making sure that the employees utilize it effectively and optimally before those changes. And then at FTE neglect and CCMA, even though we didn't perform status of records review, we went in just to high level after the status of implementation of action plan and noted that management has demonstrated commitment in implementing action plans. They firstly monitored the action plans and they developed action plans and they are frequently monitoring the implementation thereof to improve the audit outcome. So if they keep up with that, we might see some improvement where the audit opinion was modified or where the internal controls were weak, we may see improvement. So overall, at Dole portfolio, if management implements the action plan, we will see improvement in the status of internal controls and if they adjust the previously identified or reported material misstatements, there will be some improvement in the audit report. Thank you, Chairperson. That's the end of my presentation.
Thank you very much, Ms. Susanna, and your team. Members, are we happy? Can we get indication for clarity-seeking questions? Remember, members, we have to interrogate this and understand this fully, because it's going to assist us next week when we go to the presentations of the different entities in the department. I'm noting here the Honourable Baker, the Honourable Muteka, the Honourable Jobo, the Honourable America, and then the Honourable Mashile, in that order. Then the Honourable Madisha as well. Thank you, in that order. The Honourable Baker.
Thank you, and thank you once again for doing this for us. A little bit difficult for us to fully follow, because obviously we've just seen it now, but thank you very much. Thanks for the hard copy. If I can go, I think it's slide 16. My slides didn't actually come out because of the black bar at the bottom, so I apologize, I might have the wrong slide. But I think it's 16 where you've done the colors where you said concerns identified. Am I correct with that one? It's all those yellows that I see around there. And you basically that means, and it's all unchanged, so what you're actually saying is it's very similar to what we had last year. I don't have last year's performance in front of me, but my recollection is exactly the same. In other words, nothing has changed at all, despite some of the sentiments we received from the department, nothing's changed, and you are driving that. Okay, if I could then go to slide 17, and this is the compensation fund is a real bugbear. If you look at slide 17, you've actually said intervention is required. And you've got high levels, you want urgent intervention, high levels of concerns. And again, nothing's changed there. And I understand that there's been no improvement at all since last year, when you pointed out to them. Okay, if I could move on to slide 18. A little bit better at UIF. But again, the concerning issues and intervention, again, you're pointing out to us that absolutely nothing's changed from last year. It's pleasing to see that the financial health is still good with the UIF, but you're saying again that you have enormous problems with the IT, oversight and monitoring, and compliance management, but worse, the financial management is looking terrible. That's what you're saying to us, that you want urgent intervention again. And again, it's all like last year. It's almost like a flag against Sam. Am I correct in understanding that? If I can go to slide 19, with the compensation fund, which is the bugbear, often to all of us, again, you can't assess their financial health at all. So as auditors, you're actually walking away and saying you can't assess it. Am I correct in that? I don't understand. It's a challenge to assess.
So, Honourable Bagram, can you just pose your questions and then we'll ask them to respond after?
Yeah, no thanks. That's what I'm busy doing. If you listen to me, I'm actually posing questions. So I'll go on to slide. Slide 20, the Department of Labour itself, from what I remember last year, that there were finance lease commitments that showed weaknesses as well. All these three bullet points or arrows that you've said earlier were the same as last year, where they haven't indicated it. I'd like to know if I'm correct in my assessment. I think it's 21, when you look at transaction with related party at compensation fund may not be at arm's length. What do you mean by related party? Is someone related to an individual, or is it leases between entities? So I'm not sure what you mean by related. And then there's no contract management. Do you mean that there's no contract? I'm not sure again what that one is. I'll go to the next one if you want to add the number for it. And that's two slides down. Key matters for attention, procurement and contract management, Department of Labour. The department's functions are mainly decentralised. Is that normal? Are they normally decentralised in other departments and other areas other than the Department of Labour? And if it is normal, what are the ways forward? Because you're saying there is material non-compliance. I'm not sure how they're going to comply. Maybe you talk directly to the department and give them advice. And you're saying that increases the risk of irregular expenditure. And you said the same at the bottom of that slide as well about compensation funds, inadequate contract management. Performance lead to IT contract extensions and possible fruitless. Now, the compensation funds have told us that they've now got a new contract with IT and it's working and it's perfect. I'm not sure what that's all about. Maybe you could just point it out to us. Slide 24, where you talk about the compensation fund fraud investigations. I'm not sure, but are there any, have you found, I mean, I think this is all the same slide as last year, in that is there no new fraud? I don't think there is. And this is 116, I think, from my memory, that there were last year. And what you pointed out to us is that it hasn't moved. And somehow nothing's happened. Am I to understand that correctly? So there's no new fraud. This is the 6.6 million that we had last year. And they were promised that we would sort it out, but there's nothing new. And the consequence management, a little bit lower down on slide 24, when you're saying that 216 cases of irregular fruitness, of which 168 are still under investigation, that's not new. Is that new stuff? Are we adding new stuff to it, or is it still from last year? And then obviously the investigation is taking from 1 to 4 years. You pointed that out to them last year, am I correct as well? And maybe you can just come back to me on that. And then you obviously said the slow investigation process. Well, obviously, if it is, it hasn't moved from last year. That's in slide 24. I'm going on to slide 25. It's pleasing to see that the positions at the executive level are full, but you're still saying there's a lack of skill at various levels. In other words, are you saying they need to change people as opposed to filling positions? I'm not really understanding that. The IT management, you're saying it is in progress, at the bottom of page 25, and yet you pointed out earlier on that the CF has a problem with its IT. I'm not reconciling those two issues myself. At slide number 26, I think it is, additional matters at CF, the high number of fraud and financial management investigations. I don't think that's fair in the sense that you last year you pointed that it hasn't changed the number. You're just pointing it out again to us. Am I understanding that correct? So I don't think it's fair. I think they've put an end to the fraud, or I'm hoping they've put an end to the fraud. And maybe you could reassure us. I know Mr. McFutter's working hard on that. duplicate payments made in prior years not recovered. You haven't picked up any duplicate payments this year, I hope, but you haven't indicated whether you have or not. This is from prior years, before the Mafata regime. I'll go down a little bit. You said recent suspected fraud incidences. Is that this year, the suspected fraud incidences? And have you picked it up, and are they investigating, do you know? To slide 27, you said the key concerns, and there's a culture of poor performance. In what? Is that only in CF? Are you reporting a weak internal control environment? And you're saying there's a lack of urgency. Is that current lack of urgency? Is that with increased instances of fraud? I mean, are you saying that it's increasing this year, instances of fraud and possible depletions of funds? I thought that was from previous years. You're saying new staff are overworked and leave the entity or adapt to the culture. Have you discovered that this year? Is that happening now? Are you seeing that at the moment? And then this, I'm sure one or two of my colleagues might complain about the consultants, but they don't seem to be improving or they're not actually assisting from what I understand. And maybe there's a problem there, and why don't they, instead of extending it, why don't they just cancel it? I don't know if you looked into that. Slide 28. Overall recommendations. You're saying a culture of good and strong work ethic should be shown from the top down. My understanding and this committee's understanding is that that is in fact happening. We're getting reports of the strong work ethic at the top. So I'm not sure where you got that from. And then stabilize the IT systems. We've been assured by the CF that in fact it is stable now. And maybe have you looked at it up until a few months ago, or are you referring backwards? I think that's where you left off. Did we go on to SEE? I don't think we did. Okay, I haven't looked at that. Thank you, I'll stand down.
Thank you, Honourable Pegram. Honourable Mukeka.
Thank you, Chairperson. And let us welcome the presentation. Chairperson, it is very much concerning to find that the report is pointing out that in many areas there have been no improvement even after the Auditor General intervened or advised previously. I'm looking on all entities and I see only CCMA doing well. The rest, including DOL, Department of Labor, the one that is supposed to show others what is done, the one that is supposed to oversee and lead by example, is one of the poorest performers. And I must commend the leadership at CCMA for having many areas being improved and keeping about seven grains with only one layer. Well done. That's what we want in the government entity. That's the kind of government we want. And you know, CF Last time when I was in this committee, CF was a problem. The oil was a problem. Till today, there are still problems. Maybe you can guide us. Are you getting cooperation out of these non-improving entities when you do the audit? Or exactly what is happening? There are fraud cases. Are we really, as Parliament, giving out money to those fraud sharks? Because if there are 12 cases that are under share for 12, more than 12 months, not touch nothing, what message are we sending out? That we don't care about the 6 million. Those cases are within 6 million, but no one is worried about them. And maybe we can ask the department, what is your intervention at CF? Even intervention at yourself, because you yourself are not doing anything good anymore. So in fact, we can recommend that CCMA must go and teach the rest, because that's the only entity that is performing. I'll be in the mother book, which is stolen in this case. So CCMA management or leadership must go around and teach these people how to make use of people's mind effectively. But the question is just one. Are you not getting a cooperation from these people? Because you told them there's no improvement. Dollars got a yellow oil in all areas, and there's no improvement. The error is just constant. It shows you they don't care. Audit next day, they don't care. They are left. Nothing is monitoring them, nothing is biting them when they don't perform. They are the bosses of the country, that's all.
Thank you, Honorable Tenker. I think indeed, Honorable Members, our vocabulary is increasing with the addition of the new words like fraud, sharks, and things like that. On a lighter note, the Honorable Njobo.
Thank you, Chairperson, and welcome the presentation. Mine is on DOL. There is a, on your presentation, there is this witness special on financial statement. I think you can explain more about this commitment and this entitlement, so that it can be able to, I think we can help us make next week when I give you the details.
Thank you, Honorable Njobo, the Honorable America.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Good morning. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen, for your support. I think, Madam Chair, if one look at the mere graphic depiction of the department, I cannot help but be utterly disappointed with what is presented to us. My colleague was saying earlier, with the exception of the CCMA, the sort of evaluation of the department's annual performance plan is not something that's very sort of uplifting. So I think that the evidence of little improvement within the department really have light on this committee. He said, it's indicative of the fact that we have not performed the vigorous oversight that we ought to have played. Every quarter department, labor and its entities come and present the quarterly reports. It looks glossy. It looks, everything is hunky-dory, etc. And we just give them a pat on the back. Yeah, and then we say, listen, you must improve that you haven't achieved your target. When it comes to the compensation fund, they have for the past year or more, they have implemented a turnaround strategy, action plan, etc. They come and present them and promise that sterling progress is being made. And yet, if I look at this, not much has been done. Alternatively, and then next week again we will have all these glossy booklets, etc., you know, setting out all these lofty ideals and objectives for the year. And once again, it will be recorded as if glossy presentations and booklets translate into effective service delivery. He doesn't, we know that. But then actually my concern is that I welcome the report, but I think this is simply just a summary of your actual report that you have presented to your department. It is much more detailed and it's much more focused into those areas that need improvement. And in the absence of that, and that's one of the reasons, Madam Chair, that we are unable to interrogate the departments and those turnaround strategies and action plans, really thoroughly, because very often this committee doesn't have all the information. And I want to request, Madam Chair, is that this full report should be given to us so that we could exercise our function of oversight in interrogation, critical interrogation, very thoroughly. And because when one can pick little things here and there out of this presentation, but it doesn't enable us to interrogate those action annual performance plans and the subsequent quarterly plans effectively if we don't have deeper insight into the rockets, it's respecting taking certain departments. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Honourable America, the Honourable Natisha.
Thank you, Chairperson, the members. I know the auditors are always positive. Each time they give the report, they always say that everything is on track, we're improving there, things can be improved there, etc. But then, in my own opinion, I think we have problems there. I wish to agree with the Honorable Belgium that albeit there are improvements in some areas, there is no concept that some important areas have seen no such improvement. I'm taking this from the past financial year. There still are problems, and one has gone through that, of course. There are no changes. Now, one, apart from the proposals, which I think are not enough, what do you think truly we've got to do, particularly after the sessions that have been raised, can you give proposals for improvement? I mean, in this instance, let's simply move away from being this kind of professionals or say everything is on track, etc., etc. What do you believe we should do to make sure that we then are able to move forward? I have checked, as you were giving, there are very many decentralization, actually in all this section, whether it's the CCMA, in the flag, etc., etc. This then, in my own opinion again, does not say that although it is one or two there, etc., there is a proper way forward. We don't want to see decentralization. We want to see improvement only. What do you think should be done? Now, the other thing that you have raised as we're giving an input is the perpetual resignation of staff. Have you been able to check why, as we're going on with the audit? Is this due to their incompetence or corruption that is presently permeating our country? I mean, some people will resign basically because they are incompetent. Some will resign in order for them basically to run away. And that is something that we know is happening in a whole, in very many other industries and or factories and or companies. Are we having the same thing in this instance? If you can just explain, so that when we sit as a committee to discuss and have this whole thing finalized, we look into that as well. Yes, you have centralization. Most of the work, as you put it, happening in the lower structures is no longer centralized. Now, you have indicated that we have this kind of problems. People are down there. They simply go away. Okay? They resign, like you have said. Is this as a result of some of them having stolen, so that we have this kind of regress that you have spoken about? Or is this as a result of their being unable to perform the wish they are supposed to perform? Thank you.
Thank you, Honorable Magician, Honorable Mashile.
Thank you very much, Jefferson. I think let's thank the work that the Auditor General has done. And one hopes that the documentation that they've prepared and the information that they've shared with us should be able to capacitate ourselves to interrogate the different entities as well as the department. Of course, Chair, that maybe we should raise up this specific matter that the role that the Auditor General is playing is a role that they assist us to actually do our work with the department and the entity. And they don't have an obligation of really accounting the information that they give us, then we should pursue the department to explain themselves, the entities to explain themselves. I think we should pick up from the presentation that there are issues of material misstatements in the department and issues of internal controls and financial misbehavior and the PFFA issues and the lack of contract management, which is very problematic. And I think these are the things that we just need to pick up and run them to the relevant entities. And those entities that must actually account and respond to these things is why this is happening in them. And then from there, then we can have commitments from the relevant entities and the department, how they're going to sort this out. Sure, is the Auditor General cannot make proposals because I think they are not in charge of implementing any proposal that they may be thinking of doing. They can only just highlight areas that we must pay attention to when we speak to the relevant department and the entities, and that is where our biggest job is. Thank you.
Thank you, Honorable Mashile. Honorable Teko Bidai, CUN.
Thanks, Chair. I think overall, I wanted to Honorable Mashile covered some aspects that I wanted to check with the Auditor General. However, the overall recommendation on the report, it states that the PF on the IT. I wanted to check that if you use IT, it doesn't cover everyone because it looks like everybody, the IT system is not in place. It should be stabilized, all the entities, including even the department. So I wanted to check the emphasis on why specifically on the composition and fund. And again, the issue of professionalism, the low morale on the compensation fund, is it because of the appointments that are made there on that department? People who are qualified or there are people who are not qualified there, that makes the whole system to collapse on the compensation fund according to your findings. And again, is the issue of the page 11 when you indicated the issue of every you have assessed there are no material, let me speak what is here instead of there are no material issues identified. But however, to me, it confuses because the whole system, it seems like there are those who are regressing, there are those who, the department itself, the system, you are saying, those ones, it might change because you must go to a regional and check the regional officer. So please advise me, why is this sentence on page 11, it says something else, but the outcome itself, it talks something else.
Thank you, Honorable Teko. I'm also mostly covered by the members. Just on page 15, taking into consideration that what you just presented to us is relating to issues up until the 31st of December, which is at the end of the third quarter. So there's only one outstanding quarter that needs to be assessed. So you indicate on page 15 that you've identified methods and assessed progress. Are you continuously also providing guidance in terms of recommendations on how to remedy the situation as you give feedback? Then in terms of page 26, when looking at compensation funds for the risk indicators, we know about this issue that been coming on for quite a number of years, but then you re-emphasize the high number of fraud and financial management investigations. So my concern, as well as the next one, on the duplicate payment to medical service providers, as well as those outstanding loans that haven't been received or recovered. Are there any new cases that you found happened between the first of April and the end of December? Then the last bullet point you mentioning about recent suspected fraud incidents. If you are talking about recent, how recent is that? Because I thought that we are only talking about the old ones. Then you are mentioning on page 27 there's a culture of poor performance and weak internal control environment. Poor performance from who? Is it from senior management or general across the staff? And there's no, I'll pause there. Thank you for that. You may respond. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson. I will start with the fourth question. Going into fourth questions that we're responding that. And just before I respond to the question, to remind the members the objective of the review process. The review process objective is to identify key areas of concern early before we come, start with audit, and flag them to management. We're not raising findings, we're saying management, pay attention to these areas and address them before we even come for audit. That is a value add initiative from our part. And so in most areas that we have highlighted, it is mainly because of that. We're highlighting to management to say, if you don't pay attention to this, it may result in the findings, it may result in fruitless and wasteful expenditure, it may result in more qualification areas in your audit report. Okay. So I will then start responding to the question. On slide 16 and 17, the member needed clarification on whether these data of key areas were really unchanged. Yes, we are saying from the time when we issued the audit report on the 31st of July for the period ending 31st of March 2016 and 17 to when we performed the review in December 2017, the data remained the same, and that is based on the action plans that we reviewed December 2017. We reviewed the action plans, and most of the action plans were still in progress, so the status remained the same. And in some instances, management would say they implemented, and when internal audit went and verified, you would find the lower number of implemented actions by management. So question 1 and 2 on slide 16-17 is answered. And on financial, UIF financial management data of internal control, it was read because of that disclaimer opinion that was issued on the investment, and because of not consolidating unlisted investment and the reconciliations that were not performed properly and information that was not provided by UIF management to auditors. So that impacted very negatively on the status, on the financial management focus area. And CF financial health, that we can assess it, and we cannot assess it when we have qualified the areas of, for instance, the receivables and payables that we use to calculate the essential financial ratios to assist us with the to report on financial health. So in the disclaimer environment, we are unable to assess the financial health if the areas are impacted. Related parties, the member asked if it was a particular individual. It is actually the company that has entered in, that is a related party with CF, and they provide services while they have relationships, either in terms of the members being represented on board and so forth. It is not a specific member. Contract management, question number 7. Yes, there's inadequate monitoring controls on contract management. We reported it in the last financial year of audit. And when we came back for this review, high level review, we said we reported the contract management inadequate control. Now we come in, what we're seeing is the extension of IT contracts. Could it be because of your inadequate contract management controls? So we flagged up to management to say, strengthen your controls and implement the recommendations that we gave you over contract management system. And the investigations, you asked if there were new fraud or financial misconduct cases. Chairperson also asked that question. Yes, when I checked my register, now it's about 70 new cases. We actually have 70. On the register, we have a register of new cases. So for the financial year of May 2016, started from April 2016 to now, there are 70. And so when we went back to that, the contract register and fraud register as well, was to follow up on the action plans, because we have been reporting to management to say there's slow progress in wrapping up the investigation. How far are you? And we found that the process is still very slow and the new cases are adding on the register. And the positions, you asked about the positions, they are filled by the lack of skill. That's bullet point of lack of skill. Actually, when management gave us the action plan, they had identified some of the root causes as lack of skill. And from various levels. So when we reviewed, we looked at the action plan that was signed off and the quality of action plan. My apologies, Shepard. So when we looked at the quality of action plan that management had developed and commissioner signed off, there were still actions that were not addressing the root causes. And the implementation was slow, and the one of the root causes that we identified said there was AIDS was due to lack of skill. So that was information that we obtained from management. And so there was another question to say that, are we assisting management? One of the things that we did was to say management were to highlight those areas where the root causes were not properly identified. To say management, you need to identify proper root causes so that you don't waste your time addressing the internal control deficiencies that are not going to make a difference in changing the outcome. So we have communicated that. And also bearing in mind that we have to be independent, we also went in to say to help management in terms of giving them workshops on how to identify root causes, and the internal control deficiencies that could be easily addressed to make a difference. Those were the kind of things that we performed to add value, to help management to say you can move faster if you focus on this area and if you put these actions in place. The fourth indicator, again with that, we said the purpose of the review is to flag areas of concern. So when we are saying in the weak control environment, the environment is conducive for fraud to take place, we are flagging it to management to say go and address those fraud instances. We say even though there are no new cases, in this case there were new cases of fraud and financial misconduct. We say if you have those instances, you will have fraud. Enticing employees is conducive. It makes the environment conducive for these kind of things to take place. So we say to management, close this end. Complete your investigation so that your processes are in order to close gaps for fraud to take place. And indeed with the other fraud instances, the duplicate payments, it was those all duplicate payments where we were saying, management, why are you not finalizing recovery of these? Is there something into that? Have a look at it before auditors come or anyone come to find something in that. Why is it not moving? Why are you not recovering? And culture of poor performance, where you have action plans not being implemented and outcomes are not improving, if that is poor performance. And if you look at how long it has been carrying on, how long it has been happening, how long has the status been the way it is, that is basically what I meant, that this culture of poor performance. And the member asked about whether the staff members are resigning due to this fraud. And all of that, when we look at the fraud investigation registers and financial misconduct, management would have documented that the staff resigned. So the cases are not concluded, the staff resigned. That is information that we're getting from the register in terms of whether they're resigning because they are running away from the. I cannot confirm that in my position. Are people in the SDF qualified? Yes, the people are qualified. What we said under HR was that the positions are filled. Management, we have seen your efforts in filling vacant positions. However, there hasn't been any change in the outcome as yet. That is what we are saying to management. Perhaps enhance and strengthen your processes, because now you have filled the position and we are not seeing any improvement in the audit outcome, what is happening. With regard to supply chain at door decentralization of the supply chain at door, and Jirani will assist me with that, but what we were flagging there is that even though there were no findings during the review process, there was nothing that we flagged from our side. Our concern was that the risk is high where the decentralization of supply chain is happening at the region. So when we come for audit, we could have something. So we say to management, strengthen your monitoring controls at the region, because it is not where you are able to control it yourself. We say the risk is higher. And Chairperson, you asked if we continuously advising management. Yes, this is the whole intention of this initiative, to say after reporting, signing the audit report, we follow up on the implementation of action plans. Those are one of the things that we do to support management and to add value, to say how far are you and in your processes, let us see your action plans. Have you developed the actions that will address your root causes? Will they make a difference in the audit outcome? And if that is not happening, we then flag it. That is the support that we give management, to say maybe focus on these areas where you know that you can make a difference in the audit report, in terms of the audit number of audit findings that are there for CF, for instance, because we have a couple of qualification areas. Even if it remains a disclaimer, you can target certain components in the financial statement, address them, and have a difference between when we reported in the previous year and in the current year. So that we have also set with management to advise. And the new cases, I have responded to the other cases. The recent suspected fraud, we said, there have been, we have suspended about 35 employees, and even though they were brought back, those are fraud indicators to say, strengthen your processes and beef up your control, so that you don't have these instances of weak controls where employees are enticed to commit fraud and all of that. So I was actually talking about those cases that we were aware of that happened in 2016, not in December period. I was referring to that period. Of the 35 cases. Mema asked about poor performance. I spoke about poor performance. Who? If you look at the outcome and ask yourself who would be responsible for each area in the qualification, the fraud, ultimately, if it's the lower level staff, they must have supervisors, the supervisor must have manager, the manager must have the executive and the commissioner. I'm sure I will leave it to you, Chairperson and members, to decide on that one. But if the environment is not changing, the outcomes are not changing, surely there's poor performance.
Are you there?
This is another workshop that will respond to all questions on financial statements. This is another meter of your that have not responded to adequately. Thank you, Jane. With regards to the needs collected related to your finance leases, these are the samples that we purchased for the use of the inspectorate division within the department, that is the program 2, and other employees who basically need. So basically, at the time of the leave, you the department entered into a new finance lease, and at the time of the leave, you were still uncertain as to how to account for it in terms of how do you capitalize the finance lease, taking into account your data charges, etc. So they were actually in communication with National Treasury, and I think as of 12th of February as well, they have not gotten any feedback from National Treasury in terms of that. We will follow up in terms of now going into final as to how far they have progressed into calculating the specific financial statements. Then in terms of leave entitlement, this is basically, as you're aware, the department is decentralized, so it's basically attaching your leave forms onto your personal system, and once your leave forms are captured into your personal system, in terms of disclosures, in terms of your modified cash basis account, you need to disclose leave entitlement. So basically, you're just looking at the amount of leave entitlement that is disclosed in your financial statement, so this comes up being incomplete. So basically, that is the whole issue on the leave entitlement. That's the two questions addressing the leave entitlement. Then, just as a clarity, in terms of the performance management, in the past, you'll see there was some improvement in performance over the years. The whole three programs of the collective audit team used to have qualified opinions, and then it reduced to two programs, and then to one program in the previous year. So what we've done was, in terms of the state of records review, what we've done was just to zoom into the qualified program of the previous year. So what we just did was a very basic step in terms of agreeing what was reported in your performance report to the source documentation. Because if you audit your financial statements, you will be looking at your trial balance, your general ledger, and your financial statements if it's agreeing. So basically, we did that one basic step in terms of between your supporting documentation, that being your resistance in terms of your inspection, and tying it back to what was reported in your quarterly reports, and we found differences there. So basically, what we said to them was, go back, do that one basic step, because if you do not have the source document between your financial statements, we can stop auditing it in terms of our methodology. So basically, we've asked them to go back and correct. And look, so when they come into final, that they have addressed at least one preferred initial step in terms of us stopping auditing. So from now to the preparation of financial statements, we have made commitments that we will discuss the material issues, because these are the issues that will reduce the number of material cases getting to the financial statements.
Thank you. Thank you very much for that response. I'm sure that's really going to assist us in moving forward, and members take into account that this is not just the final audit report, it's just to assist us in moving towards the final audit report. Honorable Madisha, one issue. Honorable Madisha, Honorable America. Can I just, no thanks. Honorable
Madisha,
Honorable American,
then
Honorable
Taylor. Just one word from yourself, in respect of the response. Now, the responses you have given indicate that we are addressing what continues. Of course, last year, in the past financial year, and there have not been any major improvements. Secondly, that the management was advised to strengthen their control. Now, the answer to them, the request in you to give without any explanation, is did they? Yes, no. That's it.
Thank you, Honorable Magistrate, Honorable America, the Honorable Pilgrim.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Request, if it is possible, that we can get the more detailed report. It was not responded to. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. We will respond to that. Honorable Baker.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My comment arises out of our Chair's comments that you made that we must see this report in the light of you at least warning management of things to come. Well, you've done that for the last 4 years since I've sat here, that you've warned them and then you've had a failure in the actual audit report. Do you expect to see anything different this year? Thanks.
Thank you, Honourable Baker. Honourable Mortaker, I'm going to give over to the report.
Chairperson, I just want to hear from them. After the previous audit outcomes, you gave training in the form of workshops, and then you advised. So what is the explanation you are giving on this repetition? That's the only thing I want to ask, because anyway, the rest will be answered by themselves when you come.
Thank you. Ms. Hussain, can you respond?
Thank you, Chairperson. Let me first respond to the question that we didn't respond to about whether IT issues are only FCF or all the entities and departments. On slide 25, we reported on IT key focus areas that the action implementation of action plans were still in progress with regard to IT. It was asked by a member who went out. And the next question is whether management responded to the alert that we raised to say these are the key areas of concern, pay attention to. We have presented the report to DG and we have obtained commitment from DG that he will make sure that management address the key areas of concern and that findings don't happen. So we have received commitments from DG on the 12th of February and we went in for interim audit, which the report doesn't form part of this presentation because we are still busy and we have not discussed with DG. Management is still in progress. We are following up very closely with management to make sure that these areas of concern are addressed. And also, the plans that we have put in place with management, put timelines so that when we go in during final with internal audit, with help of internal audit, that those areas that we said are easy to address, to increase the audit report, are addressed. We have done that. We have meetings with management and we're following up closely to make sure that management is able to address. So that is the support that we can give as far as we are concerned, as we have said, what is it that you do from the last step that we have taken? We have action plans, and we have timelines, what is the involvement of internal audit, and we will follow up on that when we go to the final report. And you asked if what we reported have been reported in the previous years. This particular initiative is new. We actually piloted it on CF in our business unit and DBE. to say we will follow up the new initiative, Letters of Key Control, to give us the opportunity to engage directly with DG and the accounting authority, so that the accounting officers and the accounting authorities don't only rely on management reports to say everything is going well. We said we would go in, and the intention is to interact with DG and say this is what is going on, and obtain commitments from DG and follow up with management. So depending on the needs of the entity, we will then do it every quarter, only two quarters, or one quarter, depending on the maturity of the control environment and how we agree with management. So we're following up, and we're hoping that it will change the status of the internal control, because it's new. That is why we're following up closely with management. And like Simbongile has said, that it's from our side to add value to the audit process over and above just auditing.
Thank you very much, Ms. Kusane.
Can I just add a person? Thanks. There's been a comment about getting or providing the committee more detailed reports with the findings. Chairperson, we've got public and non-public information. So the detailed management reports, we consider them to be non-public information. So it says that 13 internal processes that need to be followed to get approval to release that information. That said though, Chairperson, there is nothing to stop the committee from requesting those detailed management reports directly from the committees. And then if they refuse to give those reports, then I think you'll be within your rights to actually establish why they're not giving you those reports and decide what is the protection you can take to ensure that you get those reports. But we will still explore internally in terms of our own processes if we can manage that. Then, as Chairperson said, there has been comment that we have been reporting the same things for the past 4 years. I think Chairperson, again, since we're also the committee from Akami, so the auditors now have been here with us for the past 4 years, and doing us the same thing. Why are you not treating the required functions to address this image? So it's not just a question for us as a committee to answer, but more importantly, it's a question for the auditors to answer, and then to be able to hold them accountable in that respect. Yeah, I think that's all I wanted to mention.
The Honourable Madisha indicates his question, the yes or no question is not answered.
I know Honourable Madisha Chairperson requested yes or no answer, but I have indicated that we presented the report to the accounting officer and obtained commitment from the accounting officer. And thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Kusane, and your team. I'm sure, honorable members, we are not going to allow any further discussions. Unfortunately, we are constrained in terms of time. Thank you for guiding yourself, and I'm sure it's an eye-opener to the committee members and those areas that you promised that you will look into in order to assist us further. You'll be awaiting a direction from yourself. Thank you very much. We're going to the next page of our committee agenda, honorable members, and that's going to be the deliberations of the Labour Bill. So we'll give a 2 to 3 minute stretch break, and then we'll resume. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay. No, we'll start after all. Maybe like after Jesus. No, that is that you have to
thank you, members. We are welcome to the department in our midst, as well as representatives from the state law advisor, and we have the parliamentary legal advisor. Can you move a bit closer, Mr. Frankie? Because we're going to rely on you a lot today, together with the state law advisor. So we start, honourable members, when looking at the report from the department on the LRA amendment, we start with the first one part in section 32, which refers to extension of collective agreements concluded in bargaining council. raised by Gopsatu Sadusa Naktu as a joint submission. The comment organized labor strongly supports the provision that enable the extension of collective agreements and invitation amendments as respond is noted. We remove all the members will indicate where we need discussions or where they must make input. So the noted part, section 32, 3B and C, there is no or between section 2B and C. And the response is this is correct, so they amend it accordingly from the Labour and Enterprise Policy Research Group. Are we clear on that one? We are moving. Yes?
The
clause
1, the
limited section. Can you just speak into the mic?
The limited section 32. If any person amendment the 1 to 2 sub 3, the substitution for paragraph B and C, there shouldn't be an or between B and C because it's paragraphs within a broader system of paragraphs. Because in substitution theory, paragraph A to G, so there's no need for an or between because they're always at the paragraph just before paragraph G. Thank you.
Department, do you agree with that explanation?
Yes, Chair. In fact, that's what we say in the question. Yeah.
Then it's clear that one. Thank you. We move section 32B, 5A, and 49.4 capital AB. The two sections refer to each other for authority and neither provide criteria for the determination. The response, no need for criteria, these sections do not reference to each other. Are we clear on that one? I'm looking for an indication from the legal as well as the department. Can we move? Thank you. Section 32, 2 capital A, proposed wording is confusing and conflicts with section 32.5. The response to this is a misreading of the amendment. There is no conflict with section 32.5 as the two sections are intended to deal with requests from parties that are representative and those that are only sufficiently representative. In the latter case, Minister has discretion to extend an agreement in terms of section 32.5. The majoritarian issue is the outlook in the department's response to the PC. Can we move on that one? Do we have input? Honourable Vega?
Thank you. The comment in reality is saying that the discretion of the minister should be somehow curtailed somewhat. That's what they're really saying. The department hasn't explained. And just given a broad answer, should we in fact as a parliamentary committee get that discretion inside it? So I think that's the real issue.
Department, can you give us an indication if that's the interpretation that you're having?
For us, I mean, if we respond on the issue of whether the minister should have discretion, I think that the law as it stands is balancing both the issue of the discretion of the minister, because in terms of extension of agreement, where parties are representative, they are a majority, the minister doesn't have any discretion. The parties request that the minister is obliged to do what they request because they represent the majority. If they don't represent the majority, then the minister, there's a criteria that the minister needs to apply. How does it affect collective bargaining which doesn't increase it? Are the parties sufficient ability? And then in applying that mind, make a decision. We think that's the balance that the Act, the present Act, has put in the system. And we don't think it's an unfettered power that is given to the minister. Because the minister must exercise that power within the confines of the put in the system.
Do the members agree with that one, Honorable Mashile?
Chairperson, I think the notion that seeks to say that the minister should not have discretion I think it is all it is wrong, because I mean you expect the minister to prepare to actually account through the department of the activities of these bodies. And therefore, should the minister need to make an intervention, you cannot actually create a legislation that prevents the minister to make an intervention on an area where he or she has to account at the end of the day. So this needs to be balanced, and the minister must have that kind of flexibility to be able to intervene as and when it is necessary. Thank you.
Thank you, Honourable Mashina. Can that be viewed and then as the majority view, Honourable Members, as being raised by the Honourable Mashina? I see heads nodding. Honourable Madisha, you want to come in?
But what I want to indicate is that the minister, in line with the law, has got to act on the basis of the legislation that is there. Now, if she is then given a chance to act just on her own without following the law, then that becomes a problem. I therefore am emphasizing that we have got to have that piece of law which is got to follow. I think that needs to be emphasized.
I think it's noted, Honourable Madisha, it's already been explained by the department. There is a specific criteria that needs to be followed before the minister do anything. So that's going to be our view as the committee, the majority view. We can move on. Thank you. We are on page 2, members. The view raised by NUMSA on collective bargaining and Section 32 amendments, NUMSA says that collective bargaining is under attack in council, such as those mentioned. The NUMSA submission accepts the proposed amendments to Section 32 of the LRA. The response is noted. That is why we are making the changes in Section 32 to protect collective bargaining. You are still maintaining with that? It's agreed upon, members. Can I get an indication, members? Honourable Begum, you want to write something?
Certainly I do. The reality is that even if the unions that represent the majority, for some reason or other, we're still saying that they can extend, which is a real problem. And I'm not in agreement with that.
Can you give us more clarity, department, what you're actually saying?
Well, the law is clear, members of parliament, the current law, it allows extensions of arguments even if parties are not majority. That's where the discretion of the minister comes in. Where parties are not the majority, they can ask the minister to extend, and the minister has got the criteria for doing that. The minister has got to look whether the parties are sufficiently representative. The minister has got to look at whether, if she does not extend, what effect that will have on collective bargaining. That's what the law presents. And there's no change there. And they were not making any amendment in that. The only amendment that we're making is that when the minister considers the representation of the parties, she should not look at both of them. She can look at either of them. Because we say this is about coverage. If the union represents the majority, it's good enough. If the employer employs the majority, the employer parties employ the parties, is good enough, because that agreement will have a wider coverage, and that's the issue that we can raise. Therefore, there's no amendment giving the minister more power here at all. This is the current legislation that gives the minister the discretion. We're not giving the minister any new discretion other than maintaining the current discretion that is in the law.
You want to
rebut
that? Honourable Begum?
Thank you. Just because it's the current law doesn't make it right. 10 million Frenchmen smoke Gouloir, is that correct? I don't agree with it. Thanks.
I'm sure the Honourable Begum and all other members that we will reach a point at various stages that we won't agree, all of us, and this disagreement is noted. In terms of the other members, I think majority view stays the same. Then we move. The next one, the first part, is also relating to the same issue that we just spoke about. Even the proposals. Can I get an indication? Thank you. Thank you. Then we move on to page 3. Reinstatement into the LRA of workers' rights to strike over disputes of rights. That's a new one. Department. Trade unions organize the majority of workers in a sector before the establishment of a bargaining council is permitted, or for bargaining council agreements to be extended to non-parties, without this being an equivalent requirement for the employer. The response amendment looks at any of the two parties. And when the first party that's leading to the, or saying the reinstatement into the LRA of workers' rights, the comment is this will be against government policy to stabilize the labor market. Do we agree on that one, member, because the department remains the same? It's agreed upon, we move forward. Section 32.2 capital A, reference to section 32.5 is confusing.
Sorry.
Honorable Vagran.
I agree with that first statement. In other words, this will be against government policy to stabilize the labor market.
Exactly.
The second part that I don't agree with, and the word any, they should be looking at both parties conjunctively as opposed to any party. Thank you.
Department, can you come in there?
This is a reflection of the policy.
I think we are clear,
yeah.
And we note the comment made by the Honourable Pagram. The next part from NIASA, section 32 to capital A, reference to section 32. Is confusing as it contains additional criteria and it is not clear whether these criteria will apply. Is that not the same one?
It is.
Yeah. It is the same, and we've raised the concern of the Honourable Pagram. The next one, section 32, 3 B and C, the insertion of all between B and C, we've already dealt with that one. Is it the same one?
Yes.
Yeah. Agreed, but Honorable Pagram, please take note that when you object, just raise it on the record, please.
I think I object to all the ones we've just spoken about.
Thank you, members. We move forward. Page. Page 4, the first part, deletion of 32.6b. The deletion of this section will allow the Minister to extend the period of operation of agreements without having to adhere to the provisions of section 32.3 and 5. This would allow parties with low representativity to keep agreements alive with no legitimate right to do so. It will impact on the legal right of non-parties to be heard and will not pass constitutional muster. The response by the department, the amendment seeks to ensure that agreements that enable the continued existence of a council, the delivery of its services and its benefit funds, are not at risk due to the inability of parties to reach an agreement. Non-parties still have a remedy via the exemption process. Therefore, the deletion of 32.6b is consequent on the insertion of section 32 capital A. You still maintain, department, honorable members, honorable Vagran?
Again, it's a very similar concept and object to that.
We recognize the objection of the honorable Vagran. The other members, can I get an indication? You agree, we move forward. Insertion of 32A. The amendment allowing for the extension of the period of operation of a funding agreement will infringe the constitutional and collective bargaining principle of majoritarianism and will infringe the voluntary nature of collective bargaining. Again, the department says see above, referring to the same thing, and again the Honourable Baker is raising his objection. But the rest of the Honourable Members agree. The next part, insertion of section 49 for capital A, there seems to be an omission in this amendment as there is no reference to section 32.3b. The response, section 49 for capital A, small a, amended to include it, or section 32.3b. I would like to urge the legal representatives to come in at any stage where they feel the need. So in that area, Honorable Department and maintaining the members, it seems it's majority view, we move forward. Thank you. Honorable Begram does not object to this thing. So Honorable Mashile, please note Honorable Begram is not objecting to everything. Thank you. The next one, insertion of section 150, capital A, capital D. Drafting concerns are raised with regard to sections 150, capital A to D, that relate mainly to cross-referencing. So the response, cross-referencing has been checked and amended when necessary. So we'll see it in the final draft. Do we agree? Thank you. We move forward. And Honorable Baker, it's been put on record, you are not counter-revolutionary. The next one, section 32, capital A, renewal and extension of funding agreement. Clause 2, the comment, it is proposed that the new proposed sections 32, capital A, 4 and small b, and A and small b. Next page, page 5. Be reconsidered and redrafted as this is a restatement of the common law. The clause is unnecessary. Let's see the response from the department. The response is the same thing. Do we agree, Honourable Members? Okay. Honourable Begram also agree on that one. Majority view then. We move. On page 5, section 69 and section 95, relating to picketing and meaning of a ballot. Section 95.9 and section 69. Comment, Center for Applied Legal Studies submits that the amendment in relation to clarifying the definition of secret ballot will reduce the autonomy of trade unions as well as to make it more burdensome to hold a protected strike and picket. They argue that this will have a disproportionate impact on women. They also suggest that the requirement to have picketing rules will impair the right to protest. The response, provision for secret ballot is intended to ensure that individual union members are able to exercise their right to decide about strike action in a democratic manner. Strike action that is decided on democratically by a majority of those affected is unlikely to be accompanied by violence and intimidation. Every strike must be picketing rules, must have picketing rules, and parties may agree on their own rules. Other the default rules will apply. We know it's already in existence. We still maintain a department, Honourable Members.
Agree.
We agree. Honourable Mashile.
No, that's not good enough. I think I'm just worried on the comment rather than the response. The comment where this center is speaking about disproportionate impact on women. Whether the department understands how the impact to women arrives.
We don't know where to take it, because they did not explain it also that, because when workers take a decision to start, they don't discriminate who goes and who starts. Now, we don't know why they think that it will affect women more than it would actually because a negative effect. Therefore, that's why we could not respond on that, because there's no evidence that they've supplied to us why did they reach that conclusion, and we don't believe that's the case.
Honourable Members, just an indication here, in terms of this section, if I can recall correctly, SAFTU also raised this issue pertinently as well as NUNSA. So just to include them as well in terms of the comments, the parties to the comments. Then, Honourable Members, we find it beneath that one. Okay, Honourable Members, Section 69, Subsection 4, 5 and 6. The comment is, the proposed amendments by expecting a CCMA commissioner to deal with a wage dispute in conciliation and to apply his or her mind to the issue of picketing rules will impact on the duration of the conciliation process and place a huge burden on the already strained capacity of the CCMA. Then the response, the amendment requires the commissioner to determine picketing rules in absence of an agreement on the rules. This takes place in accordance with the prescribed rules, thereby ensuring that the task is easier for the commissioner. The 30-day period remains for conciliation unless extended. You still maintain, Department, Honourable Members, your agreement agreed to. And the next part, commissioners are far removed from the terrain of conflict, example the workplace, and would tend to impose formal rules that have no relation to the workplace. Generic picketing rules are likely to lead to increased frustration and confrontation between workers, unions and employers. SAFTU views the amendments to Section 69 as an infringement on the right to strike, as it bans picketing unless picketing rules have been agreed or decided on by a commissioner of the CCMA. The response, picketing is not banned by the amendments. The LRA 711 referral form will make reference to the picketing rules. If no rules are agreed between the parties, default rules will be issued together with a certificate of non-resolution of the dispute. The purpose of this limitation is to require trade unions to take responsibility for pickets to ensure that the constitutional rights of others are not infringed. The level of picket line violence that has come to characterize strikes in the last few years requires more stringent regulation to ensure the orderly conduct of pickets during strike action. Do you still remain with that one? Department still remain? Do we agree, Honourable Members? We are in agreement, Honourable Moteka.
Chairperson, yeah, I stand by SAFTU view. Indeed, here we're trying to ban picketing.
Honourable Moteka has a contrary view, but all the other parties are in agreement, Honourable Mashile?
Yeah, Chairperson, I think it should be understood that when workers have a dispute, it doesn't mean that they have to misbehave and to call honor. Then you expect that the leadership of the union then must declare the dispute, then they must follow the processes of contradicting their strike on cause, and so that we remain within the laws of the country. Because like Andrew explained here, as much as anybody's right has been infringed or trampled to all, but doesn't mean that that person that is suffering has got the right to trample on other people's rights.
that has to be managed in one way or another. And so the leadership of unions are called upon to provide leadership, not to just simply leave things to, because they are angry and then they can just do everything in the world. It can't be like that in a democratic society. Thanks.
Thank you, Honorable Machine. Honorable America.
Madam Chair, in practice, you know, what will often happen is that the design of picketing rules will also be a product of conciliation between the parties while they engage in the process.
Thank you, Honorable America. Honorable Moteka.
Chairperson, what are our adults? So misbehaving is something else. Can we respect the adult workers?
Can you repeat that one?
Workers are adults before. So when we say they misbehave, we insult them. And we have been involved in strikes and we never done those things, Mr. Machine is safe. So it is wrong to say those people are misbehaving. And can't be.
No, I think Honorable Moteka, it's been referred to that in past recent years, it has been a fact, it's a fact that there has been a characteristic of violent behavior during strikes, and the orderly conduct of pickets during strike action is then there needs to be adhered to. Hence this insertion. It's not a matter that those workers who are engaging in strike actions are not being seen as adults. We are in agreement with that one, and we know the objection of the EFF in terms of that. And Honorable Moteka, you and Honorable Teko, can you please be here?
Chairperson, you are now bringing a wrong message.
No. That was on a lighter note.
It's between me and Mr. Machine. No.
Okay, no, I don't. I won't bring Honorable Tango.
Out of order, calling to order, please.
Thank you very much. Can we all behave, Honorable Members? We are moving to Section 95 in terms of secret balloting. The secret ballot undermines essential collective decision making of a strike. The forced imposition of a secret ballot and strike action is a major restriction on the right to strike. It is not only individualized and otherwise collective decision, but more fundamentally it rests from the control of workers, their ability to choose their own democratic processes and procedures. The introduction of compulsory secret ballots takes away the fundamental right that workers and unions should have to determine their own internal democratic processes. I think we've dealt with that one. There's no indication from whom this comment is coming. It's also from South, too. We've dealt with that issue now.
Why did you mean this?
Honorable Moteka?
We dare to do it when.
Sorry?
We dare to do it when.
No, we are. Can you give us an indication? Is that not referring to the previous issue of is it a new issue? The way I if someone's mic is on, can you please switch it off? Honorable Moteka, can you please switch off your mic so that they can respond?
It's not referring to a new thing, it's the same thing. So we've responded to it, and if you go to our response, it will be the same response that we've given.
Exactly, that's what I thought. So,
no.
It's a matter of interpretation. Can we, Honorable Madisha, can you switch off your mic and let's first give to Honorable Moteka, then you can come in, Honorable Moteka.
Chairperson, this item comes now, so we are dealing with it now. And I'm saying to you, this thing is taking away the right to strike from the workers. That's my position on it.
with through your majority can move this time.
Honourable Member, when we go back to page 5, to the comment made by the Centre for Applied Legal Studies, it's exactly the same comment. That's why we said we've dealt with the matter and we've discussed it there. Are we then clear on that one, Honourable Madisha?
He spoke about interpretation. Okay. That's exactly what the DG there has said. I think he said interpretation. Now, interpretation and the exact words are different. I mean, I'm going back to what he said.
Honourable Madisha, I'm really lost. I don't seem to understand. Did he can you can you
his response to the point?
Are you clarifying what the department responded to the Honourable Mateka's comment?
No. They've got to clarify that point. Because the workers can be secluded from taking a position and moving their body. That would be wrong, clearly.
So, which means...
No. You must...
Interpretation
and the exact action, those are different. Because interpretation, you may come up with your own interpretation in terms of saying this is a cup of tea, and then he comes up with an interpretation that it's a cup of water, etc., etc. Okay? Now, all that I'm saying should be the case. They need to say to us so that we can take a proper decision to take the point that has been put there.
On that issue, Honourable Madisha, it has already been dealt with, and the Honourable Moteka indicated that his objection should be registered. It's just unfortunate that you didn't come in at that stage. Would you advise us then to register your objection as well in terms of that specific point? Because all the other members are in agreement. Honourable Teko?
Honourable Mutaha, you must
yes.
Not delay the
Honourable who?
Mutaha. Because
Teka.
The thing of saying the wording has been changed, now we must relook at the interpretation again, it's wrong. You have registered the rejection.
Then we move forward, Honourable Member. We're
not
going back to that issue. We are done with that issue. We're not going back to it. Can we move forward? On page 7 at the bottom, NUMSA rejects the introduction of balloting before strike as a limitation of the right to strike. We have dealt with that issue. It's the very same issue. It's just been raised by another organization. By Sapu and Munsa.
You know, it's amazing. It's amazing because currently, as we speak in Northwest, there are people that want secret balloting. But when that is used to actually get a genuine decision of the position of people, then you have people as a problem. It can't be correct.
No, Honourable Mushila, just take into consideration, Honourable Members, everyone, single one of the individual members have their right to their opinion, if they agree or not agree. It's not debatable. You don't have to re-emphasize or bring any case law or whatever into the debate. The bottom line is, we've agreed on this matter, it's been properly dealt with, those that are not agreeing indicated their concerns or their objections, and the rest indicated, and that was the majority view. So they, no, let's not open this issue for discussion. Let's move forward.
No.
Please don't provoke the other members of the honorable machine.
Debate about it.
But that's what I'm saying. Let's not provoke each other. Thank you, Honorable Muteka. Please don't provoke each other.
At least I'm
not going to
Thank you, Honorable Members. We are on page 8. Page 8. Who organizes the ballot? Municipal unions will not have the capacity to organize such a ballot. Guidelines will be issued in relation to the reform. Guidelines will be issued in relation to ballots, but trade unions could be assisted by the CCMA or an accredited agency to conduct ballots. The concern starts to demand the repeal of Section 95 of the LRA. Unions who do not represent their members will be brought to book by those members. The response, Section 95 deals with the requirements for registration of a trade union, including the requirements of a union constitution. This section has been in place since 1995 and is key to the registration process. There have been a number of instances where union members have not been able to call their leadership to account, and the checks and balances contained in Section 95 are important to provide oversight of trade union activity by the Registrar of Labour Relations. You're still maintaining? It's clear to all members?
Yes.
Yes, we move forward. The next one, secret ballot prior to strike with the alphabet. Let me just check if it's a new point. I support it, and the submission is made that the majority of unions elect leaders through secret ballot and vote on strike. An early draft of the bill requires a ballot has been dealt with. The department is noting it in that being submitted by COSATU, the different NAC to join submission. So we've dealt with that one. The next one is also in terms of secret ballots. Just a point that's been raised there. Then the other one is on picketing rules. And the principle has been agreed upon, so we're not going to reopen it for discussion. The next one on page 10 refers to section 127 and 128 in terms of Honorable Moteka.
When you go past those, all those paragraphs, you must all the time note objection of EFF on that picketing
entity. Honorable Moteka, please take note, it's the same principle, it's just been raised by different organizations. That's why I'm saying if we've dealt with the principle in the beginning, we're not going to, I'm just saying we've been dealing with it. So it's not a matter of you agreeing now and you disagreed previously. So your objections have been raised. Just indicate when you agree again. Just indicate when you agree again. On terms of section 127 and 128, it's a new point on accreditation of agency and council. According to the memorandum on the object of the proposed amendments to the LRA, the amendments to section 127 provide that the council or accredited agency may apply for the accreditation of its dispute resolution panel. This amendment must also be read with a proposed amendment to Section 128 that will now allow for council accredited to perform dispute resolution functions to only appoint a person to resolve a dispute if that person is accredited by the governing body of the Commission. It is believed that such amendments may be contrary to the provisions of the power and functions of a bargaining council as listed in Section 28 of the Act. By interpretation, bargaining councils do not have to seek accreditation from the governing body as contemplated in section 127 for the spills of those parties as defined in section 51 of the Act. It is accepted that accreditation is only required for those disputes where one of the parties may not be a party to the bargaining council, commonly referred to as non-party disputes. The discretion and the, on page 11, the discretion and the right to appoint a panel of conciliators and arbitrators for council disputes and indirectly accrediting those persons to perform such functions is solely that of the council. It cannot be by decision of the governing body. These amendments have critical implications for bargaining councils that would want to comply with the concept of accreditation for purposes of good governance, not foregoing their right to perform dispute resolution functions to parties of council as provided for in the Act. It also has a direct implication on the state in relation to spam and control of dispute resolution functions. To prevent ambiguity in the interpretation of the Act, it is suggested that the proposed amendment of subsection 1 be worded as follows, and there's the proposal. Furthermore, that section 1 to 8, subsection 3 be worded as follows, and there's the proposal for the drafters. Page 12, yeah, it's just the wording that they are referring to. So going back to page 10 to the response, the amendment is intended to give authority to the CCMA for accreditation and not to interfere with other aspects of a council's dispute resolution function. Accreditation by the CCMA should apply both to the council as the dispute resolution agency and to the panelists of the council. This does mean that the CCMA appoints panelists. This is the same as the body that registers auditors. It registers the company and auditors. And that is coming from the PSCBC. Do we still maintain with that department, the members, Honorable America?
Thank you, Madam Chair. We recognize that it is the responsibility of bargaining councils to appoint panelists. What we disagree is that the sole discretion depends on the CCMA to accredit panelists. Given the expanded role that bargaining councils may wish to assume, given the amendments that we're about to agree to, they would often need more panelists who perform certain specific functions, not necessarily dispute resolution. So therefore we are of the view that bargaining councils are quite capable of creating their own panelists or their own sort of staff that will deal with dispute resolutions, and not be solely dependent upon CCMA commissioners or panelists that has been accredited by the CCMA. That's our position. Thank you.
Thank you, Honorable America. Honorable Bader.
Thank you. I do agree with my colleague. I just want to make two points as to why it shouldn't be the CCMA actually appointing and accrediting. Because if you have the power to accredit, you in effect appointing. The reality is that the DG said earlier on today that bargaining councils are independent. They have no control over the bargaining council. They're now trying to scratch some control from the back door because they're now accrediting them and they're now also wanting to accredit the actual commissioners in the bargaining council. You must also remember that these industries, these separate industries, have particular issues surrounding the industry. For instance, transport or building, they get experts in to come in. Some of these disputes require experts and require people to understand the nature of the job. And for the CCMA to now, as outsiders, having no real quality control are in effect accrediting people that they see as good, maybe good labor people, but don't have an understanding of that particular industry. And the bargaining councils, well, my experience has shown that the bargaining councils actually bring in dispute resolution experts in that particular industry. And they use them, they look around for people, they see what the dispute is on paper, and then they look around people who understand it. It makes it a lot more efficient, and to a large degree gives fairness to the parties because they understand that dispute. So what we're doing over here, and I reiterate the point that the Department of Labor is trying to creep in the back door by saying we want to accredit this. And it's contrary to everything that we believe in, and that here you have parties that are independent, the long-term independent body, and want to be able to control their disputes. So I'm against that. Thanks.
Thank you, Honourable Begum. The Honourable American, the Honourable Begum, is disagreeing with this new for this insertion. Can we have the view of the Honourable Mashile?
Chairperson, I think we have been told, of course, that these bargaining councils are, the way that was used was autonomous. They can't be independent from the Department of Labor. And they were already committed to the And the only state entity that we have is the CCMA. And therefore, for anywhere that is done within the labor sector, that the department knows nothing or it is barred, it is removed completely, not to really have any oversight on what is happening. I think it can't be correct. Yes, there are rules of the game where the bargaining council will function autonomously as it is established, but then those panelists that are appointed by the council, whether they are specialists and the rest, what would then be the problem if they actually get accreditation from the CCMA? There's no problem. Then they are available to be appointed as and when is required by the council. But at least there is some authority that seeks to monitor quality control of what is happening within that particular area of work. And therefore, Chair, I strongly oppose what Honourable Berlin has said. Thank
you, Honourable Mashile. Can we have an indication of the view of one of the other parties, Honourable Moteka?
Chairperson, although I stand by the response from the department, but I think CCMA is in a good position because it can do better than what the department is doing. So in fact, it should be somewhere around.
Yeah,
it should be twisted because CCMA can perform much more better than all of
them.
But anyway, it's fine. I'm supporting the response of the department.
Don't do that, please. Thank you. So, Honourable Madisha, can I then assume it's the majority view?
I agree with him.
Thank you. It's then the majority view. We're moving forward. Thank you, Honourable Members. We move forward to page 12. Section 127. CAPES is not in favour of the CCMA governing body accrediting bargaining council. It's the same. Section 127 is the same thing. From Tokiso, amendments to section 127 and 128 will undermine the objective. I think it's the same thing. The next one. from CCMA. I'm sure CCMA is not disagreeing with it. Okay.
I wish I had.
I think did, but I'm just re-emphasizing it, making sure. From Hilton Green Consulting.
Chairperson, I missed it. You said you sure CCMA is not agreeing with what?
They are agreeing. I'm sure they are agreeing.
CCMA?
Yes, with a proposal. They want to do it. They agree they want to do it.
Thank you.
From Hilton Green Consulting, the same. Powers of governing bodies should not include the vetting of accredited agencies to dispute resolution panels. The same. Another one, the same. From BCCEI. It's the same thing. The one from SAOM textiles. Powers of the governing body should not be included. Dating is the same thing. Section 135. Resolution of disputes through conciliation from PSCDC. This amendment is confusing. It is not clear if the amendment intends to prevent prolonged postponement of matters at conciliation, or does it provide for mechanisms where the director believes where reasonable prospects exist. A further postponement of the conciliation for not more than 5 days will result in a matter being resolved. He or she may then arbitrarily decide to postpone the matter. It is also not understood why a matter will be postponed by a director if a party refuses to agree to such extension being unreasonable on page 50 or not, as the party will still return after 5 days with no settlement. Subsection 2, capital A, is also not clear what happens if the party diarises. The diaries does not allow them to convene within or on the first day. It also does not consider the already published case roll of the CCMA or bargaining council for the first day or any other day before then. It is suggested that the proposed insertion of Section 2 capital A be deleted in its entirety. It's noted that Section 2C allows for the exclusion of application where the state is the employer. This is welcome. However, the note in the memorandum that states that no extension is however permitted where the state is the employer cannot be correct as a blanket provision. Extension is provided for in terms of the dispute resolution procedures and the rules of those bargaining councils where the state is the employer. Page 14, the response. The intention of the agreement is simply to allow for a further extension to the conciliation period. As the comment notes, this does not apply to the state as the employer, which is confirmed by the memorandum. That's an administrative thing. Do we agree, honorable members? We can move. So we note the comment and the response. The bottom of page 15 is the same. Nothing new, department. Page 16. From Oxfam, it's the same, extending conciliation. The next section, 150 capital A, 150 capital B. Can we have one meeting member, please? Can you intervene there, Honorable Bagram? I trust you. we accredit you now. Honorable members, section 150 capital A, 150 capital B, 150 capital C, and 150 capital D. Matters concerning the advisory arbitration panel. Again from the PCBC, the principle of introducing advisory arbitration is one that is supported. Parties need to have an alternative mechanism to unlock deadlock. However, this cannot be done at the cost of the ideology of our labor legislation. And then the argument follows there to page 17, including proposals. Let's see the response from the department. The main proposal that the request for an advisory arbitration should be by a majority of the parties would defeat the purpose of the amendment. It is intended to trigger an advisory arbitration in the public interest if the conditions specified in the bill are present. The amendment will apply to the public sector as much as it will to the private sector. There should be no additional requirement for public sector disputes where an advisory arbitration process is triggered. What are we agreeing with the department, honourable members? I see nodding. Everyone is in agreement with the honourable Pagram. Thank you very much. We are moving. We are therefore on page 20, section 150, the composition of advisory arbitration panel should be extended to a person or association of persons who may have a vested interest in the dispute. That's something new, and that's in terms of the composition. Then the response is a person or association of persons materially affected by a strike or lockout may apply to the Labour Court for an order to have an advisory arbitration panel appointed. The composition of the panel need not change. However, as the panel members are envisaged in the amendment, will be required to have the relevant expertise in arbitrating in this dispute. Do we agree with the department's response? The Honourable Madisha?
I agree. However, I just want to check, how are we then going to check that says that yes, indeed, they have the, what is that, check, they have the knowledge, the power to do that, as you put it.
I'm sure there should be documentary proof that it's indeed those people have the relevant expertise. Honourable Machine and then Honourable Begram.
Chairperson, I just need to be assisted on the comment and the response. I'm not sure whether I'm interpreting exactly the same as the department. Because if the comment is complete, it says composition of the advisory arbitration panel should be extended to a person or association, the composition of the advisory panel. But then the response this side looks like it is talking to the service of that panel should be extended to a person or associations of people. That's what I'm going to look at.
Can I direct you, Honourable Mashiro, to the part in the middle where it says the composition of the panel need not change. However, as the panel members are envisaged in the amendments, will be required to have the relevant expertise in arbitrating in the dispute. The Honourable Begum.
No,
yeah, I think there's a real problem here. I actually think we've captured the comment from SAFER wrong. I think there should be a word not inserted. The composition of the advisory arbitration panel should not be extended to a person or associated person who may have a vested interest in the dispute. Because otherwise it sounds like Alice in Wonderland. In other words, I've got a vested interest in the outcome, so I'm now going to be an arbitration panelist. That sounds very similar to some of those arbitrations I've been in recently, but I presume they meant not. And I presume the department is responding to it with the not in it.
Let's check with them what their intention is.
What this question is that they are asking that, I mean, if you look at section 50, the previous chapter that we talk about, is that the parties involved can apply for an advisory application. Say, you know, so the employer can say, Minister, let's set up an advisory application. Now, what they are saying is that there are interested parties who are not parties to the dispute necessarily, who are affected by the strike. And the law, now, this answer, the first part of the answer is dealing with that, where it says that people who are materially affected by the strike can also go to court and say, an application, advisory application must be set up to deal with that strike because we are materially affected by the strike. And they must prove in court that they are not parties to the strike, but the strike is materially affecting them. Let us say maybe if you work in the economy, number of business in Cape Town, because people can't come to work, and the strike goes on for 6 months, people can't come to work. They are materially affected by that strike, but they are not parties to the strike. Now, they want to be able then to trigger a resolution of the strike, and the law allows that they can go to the labor court and ask the minister to instruct the CCMA to set up an advisory application. That's the issue that they are raising in that. Now, the next issue that they are raising is that the panel that's going to hear the discourse must have expertise to hear it. And in that, the panel is CCMA commissioners, people who are arbitrators to the CCMA commissioners who are hearing the strike. And the people that support assessors that are appointed by the parties themselves, the parties, if they want assessors, will appoint assessors. But the application is done in terms of CCMA rules by a CCMA qualified or Baffin Council qualified arbitrator in that area.
Agreed. Is it the Honourable Patricia?
Yes, exactly. Thank you. And I said I agree. Only wanted this thing of the capacity of the people who are going to assess.
Okay.
So thank it's
you.
Fine.
Thank you very much.
You have
to make sure you
very
are
well.
Okay, the next part also refers to the same amendment. Proposed amendments to advisory arbitration introduce further frustrations to the right to strike. The circumstances under which an advisory arbitration panel can be convened are extremely broad, which include if a director of the CCMA deems the strike as no longer functional to collective bargaining. This enables the director of the CCMA to make a decision to effectively end the strike based on their own opinion. Let's look at the response. The provision for advisory arbitration is intended to come into effect after a strike is commenced and only in the particular circumstances indicated in the new section 150(a)(4). It doesn't interfere with the rights to strike, nor can it be used to stop strike. The award is not binding, nor does it interrupt a strike. So there's no infringement on the rights to strike in terms of the new labor legislation. Okay, we agree on that one, honorable members?
You are still pushing up the principle on coming to this thing of which has been used the right to strike. No.
Now, it's clear. The right to strike to the employees and not being taken away. That's not the indication here. Sorry? Okay, so it's subject to interpretation. But the majority of all the other members agree. Okay, thank you. we move. We go to page 22, clause 16. From the Provincial Minister of Economic Opportunities of Western Cape Government, in relation to section 158, two clarities sought on whether the parties may still proceed to arbitrate a dispute independently of the advisory arbitration envisaged in the new section 158. What effect will the envisaged advisory arbitration have on bargaining council arbitration rules? In terms of the first part, the answer is yes. The provision for advisory arbitration in the public interest will apply only to strike action or lockout where the circumstances outlined in section 158 apply. It's clear?
Yes.
Yes. So the next part also, what effect will be envisaged? There are advisory arbitration panels and any rules that may apply to them will exist in parallel to arbitration rules that are in place in the CCMA and bargaining councils. The proposed amendments to section 150 are intended to provide a way or involving strikes that are intractable, violent, or may cause a local or national crisis and do not apply to disputes that go to arbitration in terms of existing provisions of the LRA. Are we clear on that one? We agree all. Kosatu Padusa Naktu joint submission. They indicate organized labor is comfortable with the provision for advisory arbitration, so it's no match. Oxfam is also talking to the same issue that we've dealt with. Conciliation and arbitration. Saftu is asking what evidence does the director of the CCMA require prior to convening a panel. This is in relation to the section 158.4. Next page. The exclusion of certain persons from being able to represent in matters at the CCMA. Professionals are cited as a case in point. No, this thing is not to follow me. No, I'm at 23. And the next page is 26. My document is not correct. Can I have a document? So those pages are excluded from my document number. I want to have the same document as the Honorable Moteka. I don't want to be accused of sidelining certain issues, okay? From page 23, then 24. The top here. The CCMA requires prior to convening a panel, this is in relation to the new section 158.4. The response by the department, the circumstances outlined in section 158.4 are recognized by the LOO as grounds for intervention in strike situations by the state. The section 150(a)(4) are recognized by the ILO as ground for intervention in strike situations by the state. The intervention to establish a panel and make an advisory award is in accordance with ILO jurisprudence and the award doesn't suspend the strike. Are we clear on that one? Then they are indicating the system is open to abuse by the employers and they're asking how does a union of 400,000 members consult its members on whether to accept or reject an advisory award. The response, a union will first of all have to consult in terms of requirements of its constitution. Not all union members are required to accept or reject an advisory award, but only those who participate in a particular strike. Then the next one, is that one clear?
Yes.
The next one, if it is not rejected, the advisory award becomes binding. That's the statement. So the response, the award only becomes binding if one or more of the trade union's parties to the dispute accept or are deemed to have accepted the award, and if a bargaining council, in accordance with Section 31, applies to the minister to have the award extended. Is it clear? Agreed to? Majority deal. The bottom of Honorable Muteka?
For this one, I'm telling by the emails where they say the system is open for abuse, and I agree.
Okay, your point is noted, Honorable Muteka, but all the other parties agree to that. Are you saying something else? Okay. Can you please speak via the chair, Honorable Mashila? On general principles, honorable members, the comment from the Free Market Foundation states they recommended that end-stage measures not be proceeded with should be included in a comprehensive response to the former president's call for job creation. High levels of job security have costly consequences. Small firms and complex regulations, inflexibility of labor laws, regulatory bias against the employment of low-skilled workers. This response is noted. The submission makes general arguments and assumptions. They do not address the amendment of the intentions directly. So do we agree? Honourable Begren, I'm noting hands.
No, we certainly don't, and there was a point I made right at the beginning of these discussions that in fact we all have to recognise that these amendments will create less jobs, will put a handbrake on job creation, and will lead to retrenchments. I think as long as we bear that in mind, I think everyone's borne that in mind, including the Treasury, has said that it will lead to retrenchments. And it is something that we bear in mind, and that is the argument that's been raised all along by Nedbank, and that's why they said that the minimum wage will only be 20 rand, because they don't want to create more dismissals. So the comment is well placed. It should come right in the beginning there. Thank you.
Thank you, Honourable Begum. Your concern is noted. Can we, the other members are clear? Thank you, the Honourable Muteka, I agree with this one. Okay, thank you. Honourable Muteka. Now we are on page 26, honourable members. So, in general, agents from ZS Nshudu. The comment, agency shop should be abolished as it disadvantages employees. Better communication in the form of secret ballots at workplaces. Grievance procedure needs to be strengthened with punishable offences to accounting officers of labor unions as well. The comments are noted, they are beyond the scope of the current amendment, although the provision for secret ballots is dealt with in the transitional provisions to the LRA. I think it's clear to us. We agree with the department, thank you. CAPES and CACDC, The ELRA should have a clear right to approach the Labour Court for an interdict declaring a strike unprotected where there is violence and intimidating during a strike, intimidation during a strike. The response, such a provision could interfere with the right to strike. Do we agree with the department? Honourable Madisha is agreeing. The Honourable Begram?
I'm not agreeing with the department. What in fact Cates is looking for, and so the bargaining house as well, is for the right to go to a court. That's all they're looking for. It was then for a court to decide. It's not, doesn't interfere with the right to strike, because you can go to court anyway to interdict the strike if you believe that it's creating real problems. But they're just looking for it to be put into the legislation. I don't think there's anything wrong with it. There's no interference with the right, because there will still, you will be on strike, so there's your right, you're on strike. However, the department itself agrees that the right to the strike could be curtailed in situations where it creates violence, and etc., etc. So all they're looking for is the right to go to a court, and I believe that right should be granted.
Thank you, Honourable Begum. That's your view, Honourable Moteka.
Chairperson, if a DA keeps in PSCDC, they are calling for the extreme interference to right to strike. And whereas the department and the amendments are interfering. So one is confused, you don't know who to stand with, but I would rather do go with those who are not extremely quality. That is labor.
Sorry, just a moment. I think that they need my urgent attention as we move on. Just my apologies. Thank you, Honourable Noshila, you're noted.
Yeah, Chair, the one that wanted to get some assistance from the department, that probably in one way or another, Honourable Belkhan has raised. Any person at any time can approach the court if he's agreed on anything. And then now, is there any need to bring this in the legislation? And my view is that all citizens, I mean, they can approach the court if they agree on any. Everybody has for that right to do it. Therefore, this call may not be necessary. It's not necessary. It doesn't really change the situation that much, other than just simply make it a labor issue. Thank you.
Thank you, Honorable Mashile. The Honorable Begum raised his view, and the Honorable Madisha, where is the Honorable Mateka, and the Honorable Mashile raise the contrary, so that view is just, it's not holding, I assume, then, due to majority view. Can we agree on that one?
It's not holding, what do you mean?
No, it's just that the committee, majority of the members are not agreeing with that view from Cape and SPCDC. Honourable
Moteka? In fact, both comments are irrelevant. Anyway, they are all about the interference. So let's remove it and move on.
With both, you are referring to which one?
The response from the department and
No, but But we're agreeing that there's no legislative provision that the extra provision that's needed. That's the bottom line. So it's clear to us. Thank you, we agree on that point. Thank you.
So the department is correct,
madam. No, what we are saying is the committee is the no, don't say that, Honorable Mujeka. The view was from Cape and PCDC that there should be a legislative provision for parties to go to the labor court. Sorry?
What they are saying is that what case is calling for is not necessary. But then the department also agrees that no such provision is not necessary. But their reason is the one that is problematic.
Okay. So the principle is agreed to that we, the common majority of the committee members are not agreeing with the request or the comment made by those parties or those organizations, then it's agreed upon. You're making it difficult for me. We recognize the objection of the Democratic Alliance in this case, or the Honorable Bagram, and we move forward. Do you want to come in, DG?
Yes, thank you. We wanted to explain our response that we do not object to the fact that every citizen has a right to go to court on this matter. But however, we cannot put it in the law, because if we put it in the law, we would be interfering with the right to strike. If a strike is a legal strike, you can't say that in the law you put a provision that will change the status of the strike. However, anybody can go to court and say, I'm badly affected by this, and therefore we seek relief from the court. We can't stop.
If you read Section 1.8 of the LRA, on the power of the labor court, that court is empowered to plan an agent inside of the lift to make an intercept. Therefore, anybody can go to court and ask the court to intercept anybody.
Yeah.
But then when you do that, you're going to justify your claim in court, how it affects the constitutional right to strike and all of those issues. That's the problem that you're having. Now, they want the law. Remember, constitutional right can be limited. They want now the law must limit that right by giving expressly that parties can go and intercept this right. That's what they want. They don't want, they want to make it easy so that they don't justify their case in court. But no, nothing prevents anybody going to court. And the labor court has the power, because of the current legislation, to make any decision.
Yes.
As long as that decision is justified in terms of its constitutionality and legality. That's what Section 58 in terms of the power of the labor court there, presently. It's not an amendment, it's in the law.
It's clear. We move. Honorable Madisha?
No, it's exactly what I said. When I said we support the point that the department has put. And there are very many members here said no. And I think the chairperson said no. We disagree. I think with this explanation, people need to understand that yes, this piece of law, if I were to put it in that way, has actually been there for us, and then we're actually reendorsing that. Okay.
Thank you, Honorable.
It takes us forward, really. And thanks for agreeing, members.
Thank you, members, for agreeing with the Honorable Minister. The next point by CWAO, no, from Netlay Community Constituency. they comment endorsement of submission by organized labor. The communist constituency endorses the submission by organized labor and highlights the number of points contained in the labor submission. The community constituency also expresses support for labor's recommendations on the inclusion of bargaining councils for low wage sectors. This is the outlook. Okay, the next one from CWAO. Proposed amendments to the strike bill, defaulting picket rules, extended consideration and advisory. Who's the alphabet? We are moving. The next one, Chris. The LRA should have a clear right to approach it the same. From Nshudu. Agency shop should be abolished as it disadvantages employees. The comments are noted they are beyond the scope of the current amendment. We can give that message to the issue.
Shepherdson, where is the contact of this person? I want to talk to him. He is the real force.
I refer the honorable member to the fact that we receive of submissions that we receive right in the beginning. Just scan through that and you'll find all the details of the those who submitted. You receive the signal in there, Honorable Makeka. Mm-hmm. On page 28, from staff to strike notice, the staff to contend that the current requirement to give notice is an infringement on the right to strike. Amendments include new rules for strike notices which place more obstacles in the path of workers in dispute. The response, the LRA currently requires 8 hours notice in writing to the employer in the event of a strike. This is a procedural requirement that is required for a protected strike to take place and does not infringe the right to strike. The amendments do not introduce new rules for strike notices. But the amendment to section 69(6) capital A requires that picketing rules be issued at the same time as issuing a certificate of non-resolution of a dispute. Is it clear, honorable members? It's clear. We are moving to drafting of omissions from BUSA. BUSA submits that concept. Consideration should be given to the following in order to give effect to the NEDLAC agreement. Advisory arbitration, the process is not adequately regulated with regard to situations where there may be more than one union and employer party to the dispute. How are assessors appointed in multi-party situations? What are the procedures where one union accepts the award or is deemed to have done so? Will others be bound or not by the award? Subsection 150(d)(1), no corresponding provision whether the employer party to the dispute is an employer rather than an employer's organization. The response to that is further regulation to deal with multi-union or employee situations will not be necessary. In the case of a bargaining council, the decision of parties will follow the council decision-making procedure. In the case of other workplaces, decision-making will be very consensus for an award to be accepted or rejected. Section 150(c)(8) makes further provision for a panel to reconvene to mediate a settlement if required. This would also apply to multi-party situations. Section 150(d) also specifies the effect of an award on other parties. This is coming from BUSA, and that is the response. Are we clear on that one? Do we agree or do we agree? Members? Sorry?
I'm saying this will raise when regulations are promulgated.
No. I don't think so. The department?
It's not about the regulation. The issue that you are raising is that what happens when there are two unions with an award about an hour. You accept it or you don't accept it. Let's say there are 2 million, 1 million accept it, therefore it's going to stop striking. And the other union doesn't accept it, it will continue striking. There's no misunderstanding with this in terms of what happens. Because when a union is out of strike, it cannot control the other members, you know. It only controls each member. If it accepts the advisory award, then it goes the route of acceptance. If it does not, it continues. It's a simple example. There's no need to any other resolution.
Honorable, thank you, Department. Honorable Mateka.
Can you protect me?
Honorable Mateka, you are on the floor, you are protected.
Yeah, let them stop talking. It's my time now. Chairperson, I think Wooza is greedy. It was fed by Netflix, it was fed by the system through Parliament, and then the all rights of workers are in their hands. Now they want to take it with them. Are they really greedy?
No, I think Honorable Mateka, as we've agreed previously during the past few days, even though there were parties that were signatories to the agreement, if there are issues that they didn't agree on there, they have the right to submit it to Parliament for re-engagement. It was upon us to accept or reject it, and we've dealt with it in terms of the other bills, and it's only fair to allow them also to deal. If we're not agreeing with that, as this is the case, we are not agreeing, but please, can we be in order? Thank you for that comment that you've made.
Chairperson, I have to say that because they've been giving everything in the expense of the worker, so they wasn't just come here and want.
Point taken, Honorable Mateka. Thank you very much. So on that note, Honorable Members, we are all clear. In my document, there's the last item. Do we have any other items that we want to add to this discussion? Honorable Begum.
Thank you. I did receive a document, and I haven't tabled it, and I'm not going to, from the NPO sector again, because they're still unhappy about them having to be... there was some thought that they might fall under the EPW, Extended Public Works Program, which in fact they thought that the department had said that they fall under the Extended Public Works. But what I did tell them is that each NPO itself would have to apply for a separate exemption. And they're unhappy, they were hoping they could be dealt with as a sector, specifically because, and that Lisa Petten, B-E-T-T-E-N, and let me finish.
Do you have a point of order there? Honorable Machine?
Okay, thanks, Chairperson. I think Honorable Bertram is not really giving us the necessary respect that we really need as members, because the document is speaking to, we are not having any sight of it, and we don't even know the context. I think the best thing is that he must first actually get the document to the right places, and also even to the department to be able to respond to it before it can make us to engage into it. At the moment, he's just keeping us busy on something that we don't have sight of.
Now, I think, Honorable Mashile, what happened is those concerns have been raised with the committee, and the issue has been discussed. I think what the Honorable Bader wants to bring to our attention, that the specific organization or sector, they engage with him as an individual on the issue, stating that they still not satisfied, but we've dealt with that matter. So in that instance, we want to close this matter. Because we've already dealt with the relevant legislation that dealt with it. So we're going to move now from that point. Point taken, Honorable Begum. You've made your point. In terms of the next agenda item, Honorable Members, is the way forward on the processing of the labor bill before the committee. I just need to indicate to the Honorable Members, as been agreed to before we started and during the process, we've agreed that we, as we reach our conclusion of the deliberation, what's going to follow now is we're going to take the documents with the proposals and our final input or the input that we have, we want to send it for redrafting. So there will be engagement between the department, between the state law advisor, parliamentary legal advisors. They are going to deal with the documents to clean it for us. And then as per our program, it will be resubmitted to the committee to look through it to see if our concerns, and indeed it's a true reflection of our discussions and our concerns, and after that we will put it before the committee as well as before the House for adoption. Am I correct, said Lord Advisor, if I mention it like that?
Thanks for the clarification.
Thank you very much. So that's the process. I just need to bring it to the attention of the members that next week we are going to meet on Wednesday, and it will be a full day because we're going to deal with the department as well as all the entities. We've applied for an outside venue, so we've just we submitted the application, seeing that there's no venues in Parliament that's available, so we are awaiting the approval, and members will be informed in due course as soon as we receive the approval on where the venue will be, and also in terms of the logistical arrangements, what's going to happen. In the meantime, we know that the committee secretary is not around, so we've requested the department to forward all the relevant documents either to Portia or to the content advisor for perusal by the members. So we'll also receive those documents in due course to go through it. So on that note, I really want to thank the Honorable Members. I know this process was very intensive. It was very exhausting. We had our emotional moments. We fought, but we managed to conclude the three bills as been put before us. So in that case, I want to thank the Honorable Members for their commitment shown, and I want to wish you well for the weekend. Please take this rest because there's a lot of work that is also lying ahead in terms of our budget process. For now, I can give an indication to the members that our date for our budget budget debate will be on the 15th of May. So we have to prepare ourselves accordingly. I want to close it, but there's something from the Honorable Madisha and then Honorable Teko, then we are closing.
Thank you. I know very well that